Morning, I'll be reading from Mark chapter 9. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain apart by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his clothes became dazzling white, such as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Then Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it's good for us to be here. Let us make three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say, for they were terrified. And then a cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud there came a voice, "This is my Son, the Beloved. Listen to him." And suddenly, when they looked around, they saw no one with them anymore, but only Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, he ordered them not to tell no one about what they'd seen until after the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So they kept the matter to themselves, questioning what the rising from the dead could mean. And then they asked him, "Why do the scribes say Elijah must come first?" He said to them, "Elijah is indeed to come first to restore all things. How then is it written about the Son of Man that he is going to go through many sufferings and be treated with contempt? But I tell you that Elijah has come, and they did to him whatever they pleased, as is written about him." When my family traveled to Mexico one summer for a summer mission experience, I remember at one moment in one of the evenings, one of the leaders kind of gave an orientation talk. And in that talk, she admitted that when she got nervous, she could be kind of a motor mouth. It was a long time ago, but I can still remember her saying, "You know, sometimes I listen to myself talking and I think, why don't you just shut up?" And that stuck with me, possibly because I was in my teens at that time and I really didn't expect to hear a woman of her age and position say, "Shut up." And partly because maybe even then I already recognized the truth in what she was saying. But sometimes when we're nervous or afraid, we talk too much. We say too much the way Peter did. Peter was talking nonsense, Mark says, because he was terrified. That's really Mark's explanation for the way Peter responded to Jesus' transfiguration. That when they saw Jesus' clothes become bright, shining bright, brighter than anyone on earth could whiten them, almost as if Mark himself is having trouble to find the words to say this. When they saw Moses and Elijah appear with Jesus, talking to Jesus, Peter started babbling about building dwellings or structures or tents or whatever they were. And Mark explains that Peter did not know what to say. But they were terrified. They were terrified. And that's a common enough response to a heavenly manifestation. You might remember that when God spoke to Moses out of a burning bush, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. Or that when Isaiah was given a vision of God in all of his glory, Isaiah said, "Woe is me, I am undone, for I am a man of unclean lips. I live among a people of unclean lips." Or perhaps that when the angels appeared bringing the good news of Jesus' birth, the shepherds who received that message were terrified. Terror is a common response to a heavenly manifestation, and Peter, James, and John here are terrified because they see in Jesus something they have not seen before, even though there have been hints along the way. There have been hints. You might remember a number of weeks ago we read the passage where Jesus began his ministry in Capernaum, teaching in the synagogue, and we're told there that the people were amazed, they were astounded. And they said, "Who is this? What is this? A new teaching and with authority." You saw something they didn't quite recognize. And questions like that get asked more often in the gospel. For example, when the disciples wake up Jesus in a panic because the boat that they're in is about to be swamped by a storm, only to see Jesus rebuke the storm and the sea become calm, they ask, "Who is this? Who is this that even the wind and the waves obey him? Questions like that are asked in Jesus' hometown when Jesus preached there or spoke in the synagogue there. The people said, like, where did this man get this stuff? What is this wisdom that has been given to him? What deeds of power are being done by his hands? Is this not the carpenter? Is this not Mary's son? Are not his brothers still with us? Through the beginning of the gospel, Mark tells us that people are asking questions. Who is this? What is this? And I mean to follow up on some of those questions in the weeks that come, the weeks that are leading up to Easter. Because I think by telling us this, Mark wants us to ask the same kind of question. Mark wants us to ask, well, who is this? Where did this man get these things? What are these deeds of power that come from his hands? What is this wisdom that's been given to him? Who is this? What is this teaching? Mark wants us to ask this. In part because there's always more to Jesus than what we see. There's always more to Jesus than what we know. Philip Yancey began his book, The Jesus I Never Knew, with a chapter called The Jesus I Thought I Knew. And in that chapter, he talks about the Jesus he knew in Sunday school, and we associate, he said, with the taste of Kool-Aid and of sugar cookies and with receiving gold stars for attendance. He goes on to explain how in college he began to realize that the pictures that he'd ever seen of Jesus, the portrayals of Jesus, always showed him bearded with a mustache, even though the college that he was in insisted that good Christian young men be clean shaven. He talks about other portrayals of Jesus, other ways Jesus has been portrayed in art and in culture. And I think he wants us to know here that, well, we all have a Jesus we think we know. We all have a Jesus we thought we know, and the Jesus we thought we know is always, almost always smaller than the Jesus we never knew. Mark wants us to ask these questions because there's more to Jesus than we often see. We have our own ideas about Jesus, and Mark tells us that that people had their own ideas as well. So in addition to asking the questions, they come up with their own answers. Shortly before the Transfiguration, Jesus kind of turns the questions around. And there near Caesarea Philippi, he speaks to his disciples and he asks them, well, who do people say that I am? In other words, what answers are people giving to those questions they're asking? And in response, the disciples say, well, some say John the Baptist, some say Elijah, some say one of the prophets. And those were kind of the categories that people had at that time, that someone who acted like Jesus, who said the things Jesus said, did the things Jesus did, had to be fit into one of these kind of categories or one of these sort of boxes. Maybe he was like John the Baptist come back because he was doing what John the Baptist did, that is, proclaiming the word of the Lord in the wilderness, preparing a way for the Lord. Or perhaps then he was Elijah who was expected to come before the day of the Lord in order to make things ready so that people were ready for God's coming. Or if not Elijah or John the Baptist, then one of the prophets who did kind of the same kind of thing. Call people back to the covenant, remind them of what God wanted them to do and the way God wanted them to live so that they could be God's people. And so as they're trying to come to terms with Jesus, they're trying to fit him into one of those categories, maybe John the Baptist, maybe Elijah, maybe one of the prophets, or maybe something else. People had their own ideas, and we find others kind of scattered through the gospel. We've already heard that when the people in Jesus' hometown asked or heard him teaching, they said, well, isn't this the son of Mary? Aren't his brothers? They knew that about Jesus. They had a hard time seeing anything more. Later on, we'll hear a blind beggar call out for Jesus' help, saying, Jesus, son of David. Son of Mary, son of David. Or on Palm Sunday, Jesus will be hailed as the one who comes in the name of the Lord. So in the weeks leading up to Easter, as we look at some of the questions people ask, we'll also look at some of the answers they gave. Because each of them tells us something about Jesus. Each of them kind of helps fill out our picture or our understanding of who Jesus is, though there's always more to Jesus than we can know. When Jesus asked the disciples that question, well, who do people say I am? He followed it up with another question. He said, well, who do you say I am? And then it was Peter who answered, well, you are the Messiah. The Messiah, in the Hebrew word, you know, Christ, the Greek word. You are the Messiah or the Christ, Jesus the Christ. And that is the best, the most full answer that that is received in the gospel up to this point. Everything from the beginning to the middle here to chapter 9, from 1 to 9, is kind of leading up to that confession and in actually the end of chapter 8. Everything's been leading up to that. It is the most complete description yet. But as if to show Peter that he still doesn't know what he's talking about. Well, Jesus took Peter, James, and John up a high mountain where he was transfigured before them. And then we're told that Peter started babbling. He said, you know, it's good that we're here, teacher. Let us build three shelters, three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. And often when we read that, we think that what Peter's trying to do here is hold on to this moment. To hold on to this experience the way we try to hold on something to something that's good. We don't want to go down from that peak of good feeling back down to the normal everyday of life. We want to have our mountaintop experience or convention experience or whatever and hold on to whatever it was that we felt there in that kind of retreat experience. But we don't want to go back to just the nitty-gritty of life. Peter wanted to hold on to this. And that's why he suggested these three dwellings. And it's interesting, like the picture here, I found it on the web. It's of a where one church believes the transfiguration happened, and it's a way to kind of commemorate this, almost trying to commemorate this moment the way Peter, we think, was trying to commemorate it, even though, well, it can't be held on to. And even though we're told that Peter and the others were terrified. I mean, would he hold on to something that scared him silly? So others think that maybe Peter was trying to protect himself. See, the word for dwelling, as it's in the reading that we had, in the original language is the same word that would be used for the tabernacle in the Old Testament. The tabernacle, which was where the glory of God lived in the middle of the people so that they could be a people who live with God in their midst. And the only way we people can live with God in the midst is if somehow we are shielded from God's glory by something like the tabernacle. And so maybe Peter was trying to suggest that if they built three tabernacles, one for Moses, one for Elijah, one for Jesus, then they could be there with Jesus with this glory without this glory overwhelming them. Or maybe, as Mark says, he just didn't know what he was talking about. He didn't know what to say. A guy I knew was setting up for the day when a friend came up to him and asked him if he was okay. And when he looked a little puzzled, she explained that she'd woke up suddenly early that morning with a strong urge to pray for him. A sense that she needed to pray for him. And as they talked, it became clear that she woke up at the moment he narrowly avoided a serious accident on the highway. And he didn't know what to do with that. I mean, he didn't quite know what to say. I mean, other people did. I mean, other people, when the word started to trickle out, they were all over it. They thought that we should be shouting this from the housetops, that we should be proclaiming it in the church, that we should be telling the world. But he himself didn't quite know what to say. Sometimes I think we can have the right words. The way Peter had the right words when he said, "You are Messiah," and still not know what we're saying. Sometimes we can have the right beliefs when, like those people did when they wanted to celebrate this because they believe that God is with us and God is active with us and God answers prayer, and still really not quite know what we're saying. That there's sometimes when we encounter something that's really just too wonderful for words, we just simply get caught short and we don't know what to say. Because it doesn't quite fit the categories that we had or the words that we had. We catch just a small glimpse of the glory of God in the face of Jesus, and we don't know what to say. And Peter didn't know what to say here. I mean, he'd seen something in Jesus that he hadn't seen before. And then after babbling, a cloud kind of covered the mountain, almost silencing him in a sense. And a voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him." Listen. Because listen is the one thing we can't do when we're babbling incoherently because we're afraid. Listening is one of the things the disciples had a hard time doing. Listen is something we often don't do when we jump to things and we want to say, "Well, this is what happened," and we want to put it into categories right away. Listen is something we fail to do. And so even though this voice goes and gives another name for Jesus' son, "This is my son," the voice says, "Listen. Listen." It's what we have a hard time doing. When Peter said, "You are Messiah," he spoke the truth. But then Jesus began to speak to him and to teach the disciples that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering, be handed over to the elders, to the chief priests, to the leaders, to be killed, and then to rise again. And then Peter had enough. He said, "No, that's not going to happen." As if to show him that he still didn't know what he was talking about, Jesus leads Peter, James, and John up to this mountain where they see something in Jesus they haven't seen before. They hear a voice speaking and telling them to listen. And if that in some way seems to confirm what Peter is thinking when he says, "You are Messiah," as if to show Peter that he still doesn't know what to say, Jesus leads them back down the mountain. And on the way down, tells them not to tell anyone what they've seen. Jesus leads them back down from the mountain of glory to find the other disciples who are busy arguing with the chief priests and the Pharisees, arguing because they've someone has brought a boy to him that needs healing and they can't do anything for him. Jesus comes down from the mountain of glory to arguing disciples and quarreling people and disciples who are unable to do what needs to be done. If we think it's a letdown, perhaps we're right. Jesus says, "I mean, how long must I put up with this generation?" But there's something there that says about who Jesus is too, the one who is revealed in glory, comes down to be with us for us and our salvation. As if to tell the disciples they still don't know what to say, Jesus leads them back down. And then later, Jesus takes these same three disciples, Peter, James, and John, to a garden on another mountain. A garden called Gethsemane, where Jesus tells Peter, James, and John to stay in this one place for a while he goes farther into the garden to pray. And he prays there asking God, wrestling with God, asking whether the cup could possibly be taken from him. And then he returns to where the disciples are and he finds them asleep. And asks, he asked Peter, could you not stay awake for just an hour? And then Jesus goes back into the garden to pray. And when he returns, the disciples are once again asleep. And this time we're told they did not know what to say. They did not know what to say when they saw Jesus in his glory. And they did not know what to say when they saw Jesus in his agony. There's always more to Jesus than we can know. There's always more than we can say, and that's why we have to keep asking that question. Who is this? Who do we say that he is? Let us pray. Gracious God, we thank you for revealing yourself to us in Jesus. We ask that you would forgive us for the way that we shrink that vision down to fit our own ideas, our own preconceptions, our own realities. Open our eyes that we may see Jesus, that we may see more of Jesus than we know, so that we may follow and that we may live in him. Amen.